today on Against the Grain. What did the Communist Party accomplish in California, or try to? And why were the 1930s such a pivotal decade for communists here and nationally? I'm C.S. Robert Cherney discusses his new book, San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 to 1958, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You might think of the Communist Party as forever playing a marginal role in California state politics. You might assume that communists were shunned by other political actors, that they never gained significant traction with workers and other folks the party hoped to reach. You might be surprised, then, to learn what Robert Cherney, a professor emeritus of history at San Francisco State University, reveals in his book, San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 to 1958. Among other things, Cherney describes how national and international communist formations influenced and reacted to what the party in California was doing, and how programs like the New Deal and developments such as the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact of 1939 affected the outlook and fortunes of California-based party members. When Robert Cherney and I connected recently, he began with this background about the formation of the national-level Communist Party.
The organization that ultimately became the Communist Party of the United States was launched in 1919 by a couple of different groups, one of which consisted of a large number of language federations within the Socialist Party of America. The language federations were just what they sound like. They were organizations of the Socialist Party based on a shared language, German, Russian, Italian, whatever. And those language federations tended to be the radical faction within the Socialist Party. And they broke away from the Socialist Party after the Russian Revolution, after Lenin took power, after Lenin and the Bolsheviks called for people around the world to join them. And they formed their own separate organization. There were other radicals, other socialists, who also formed a competing organization. They went to Moscow and hashed it out. And in Moscow, the two factions were brought together to form an organization that went under various names in the early 20s. But by the late 20s, they had become the Communist Party of the United States of America, the CPUSA.
And at what point did the Communist Party, CPUSA, decide to create a California presence?
There were Californians involved from the very beginning of this process. When the language federations broke away from the Socialist Party, when others formed a competing Bolshevik sympathizing organization, there were Californians involved in these from the very beginning. And in California, it was the language federations of the Socialist Party especially that were prominent in the California state organization.
And was the California state organization based or rooted in a particular part of the state?
The language federations tended to be stronger in Southern California, especially in Los Angeles. But the newspaper, the first newspaper, was in Oakland, and the state headquarters were always in San Francisco.
What should we know about the degree to which people were attracted to the Communist Party in California in the early years, in 1919 and in the decade of the 20s?
Well, as I said, the language federations that split from the Socialist Party and joined what became the Communist Party were really the major group in California. Probably, as I said, more prominent in Los Angeles, but there were also other language groups in the Bay Area and all the way up the coast in Fort Bragg, where there were Finns. There was a very active Finnish language group. And this organizational framework of language federations carried on within the California Party throughout the first half of the 1920s. If you look at their newspaper at the time, you'll see that there were a lot of social activities that were organized around these language federations. So there was an important social aspect to the party meetings. They'd have an educational meeting and then they'd dance. And dancing was often a part of these functions. They had singing groups. There was a German singing group that was especially prominent. So there was this kind of a carryover from the Socialist Party that persisted until the mid-20s, when the Comintern in Moscow told the U.S. Party that they had to change their basic organizational structure away from the language federation approach toward shop nuclei and neighborhood nuclei. And the reason that the Comintern did this was that they wanted these recent immigrants who felt more comfortable in their native language to become Americanized and to become citizens and to register to vote and to take a full part in American politics. This was troublesome to the entire Communist Party all across the country. It was also troublesome in California. And there was a drop in membership when the language federations were disbanded, and there was this new emphasis upon organizing shop nuclei and neighborhood nuclei. But this was just one of the problems that the California Party faced in the 1920s.
The Comintern being the Communist International or Third International, based in Moscow. What were the, you've begun to allude to what the Communist Party wanted people, the membership in California, to focus on, but what were the sort of the political priorities, the organizing priorities of the Communist formation in California in the 20s?
As I see the evidence, and the evidence is limited, there's files in an archive in Moscow from the local party here in California. They're not complete files, but they're probably the most complete that we'll ever have access to. And there was briefly a newspaper. And then there are some reminiscences and oral histories. And those are our major sources of information about the party in the 1920s. And what these sources make clear is that in the mid-20s, there was a serious factional battle within the California Party, just as there was in the National Party, and just as there was in the party in the Soviet Union after the death of Lenin. After the death of Lenin, there was a struggle in Moscow among various factions within the U.S. at the national level of the party. Party leaders aligned with one faction or another in Moscow. And in California, factions aligned with the various U.S. national factions. And these factions shifted back and forth, sometimes based upon who was in favor in Moscow at any given moment. sometimes based upon instructions from the Comintern to heal these factional disputes, but that never really worked. All of this factionalism was really, really serious in California. At one point, the state committee just split, and there was one faction which occupied party headquarters and another faction that was supposedly the official committee. And these two factions just essentially refused to recognize each other's existence. This factionalism was combined with an understanding of history and an understanding of the way in which history was interpreted by Marx and Lenin and eventually Stalin, that suggested to many of the party members in the 1920s that their victory was inevitable, that the ultimate victory of the proletariat was going to come, that the proletariat in the U.S., just as in other parts of the industrialized developed world, would rise up, overthrow capitalism, and that the party had to be ready to take leadership when that happened. You can see this in what the party leaders were saying in California and at the national level and in Moscow. You can see this in the party's publications. They weren't saying, we are going to foment a revolution. They were saying the revolution is inevitable. What they were looking at was both Marx and also Lenin, and at what had happened in St. Petersburg when the workers really did rise up and install the Bolsheviks in power. And they just confidently expected that history would repeat itself, and it was only a matter of time, and that they had to be ready. They had to show American workers that they were ready to be leaders in this struggle. But I think this kind of millenarian thinking, combined with the intense factionalism, kept the party pretty small and insignificant in California and nationwide.
A lot more to say about the 1920s, the orientation of the party in California, the factionalism. You can read about that in my guest Robert Cherney's new book, San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 to 1958. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We have chosen to focus on the 1930s into around 1941, which you do indicate in this book is sort of a pivotal decade, a pivotal set of years for the California communists. So I'd like to move to that, and maybe we could begin by asking about the extent to which economic desperation brought on by the Great Depression was a context for Communist Party activity in California in the early 1930s.
Around 1930, two things came together in California to really change the course of the Communist Party in this state. One was the Great Depression, beginning in late 1929 with the stock market crash, and the stock market that kept crashing, and the inability of either the Hoover administration or the Federal Reserve to halt that crash, rising unemployment, coincided with the arrival of a new organizer for California, Sam Darcy. Darcy was very young, but he had had a lot of experience in his young life. He'd started out as a leader of the youth movement within the Communist Party, and had even been sent to Moscow at one point as representative of the youth movement in the U.S. after he came back from Moscow, he had briefly edited the Daily Worker, the National Party's newspaper. He had helped to organize a major demonstration in New York. But he was seen within the top leadership of the National Party, especially by Earl Browder, as a competitor. And so he was assigned to California as district organizer. And this was widely seen as sort of the American equivalent of being sent to Siberia, because the California Party was so badly disorganized through factionalism. There had been one failed district organizer after another all through the 20s. No one seemed to be able to get the California Party in organized. But Darcy arrived at the same time that the nation, the state, San Francisco, were plunging into the depths of the Great Depression. Unemployment was rising. The party's initial position on unemployment was to try to organize the unemployed into unemployed councils, organizations of unemployed men and women, presumably led by the party, who would agitate and advocate for assistance to the unemployed. Their motto was work or wages. They wanted unemployment relief, and they also wanted jobs created. So there were these councils that had been created before Darcy arrived. But Darcy began to use them in a different way. There had been big demonstrations and often demonstrations of unemployed that had turned into conflicts with the police. With Darcy, that didn't seem to be fruitful. And what Darcy did initially was to get some of the leaders of the unemployed council and assign them to help organize farm workers. Because there had been efforts to organize farm workers beginning around 1930. The party had read in the newspaper, and this is actually the way they did this. We have accounts from people doing it, that they'd read in the newspaper that a group of farm workers were going on strike. And so the party would go and try to help them and, if possible, lead them. These early efforts in the 1930s had not been terribly successful, but Darcy plotted out an approach to organizing farm workers that would take place in 1933. And what he did was to bring in organizers from the Unemployed Council, as well as other party organizers, and to follow the harvest through the Central Valley, trying to build support, because farm workers followed the harvest, and so the party was going to follow the harvest and try to build support for higher wages throughout the summer of 1933, ending up with cotton in the southern part of the Central Valley, and really focusing all their organizing on improving the lot of farm workers in picking cotton.
Yeah, in fact, Sam Darcy planned for a strike that began on October 4th, 1933 in the cotton fields in southern San Joaquin Valley. This turned into the largest strike in the history of agricultural labor up to that point. Tell us about the results of that strike and the extent to which the National Communist Party, how it felt about the California Party's focus on farm workers.
There was a mediation that resolved the cotton strike. And there was also pressure from Franklin Roosevelt's administration in Washington, pressure on the growers to come across with some kind of a improvement in wages. There was no recognition of the union, of the Cannery and Agricultural Workers Industrial Union. But there was an improvement in wages, and Darcy and his organizers declared victory. But that wasn't what the Comintern wanted them doing. At that time, in the early 30s, the official line of the Comintern, as dictated by Stalin, who had come out of the factional struggles clearly on top, was that capitalism in the West was in a third and final period of its post-World War I existence, that capitalism was collapsing, and that it was inevitable that the capitalist powers were going to go to war and try to destroy the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union presented the only alternative to the chaos of the Great Depression, which was worldwide. This notion, as translated in instructions to the U.S. party, was that the party should focus on organizing workers who could disrupt that war effort, including maritime workers, longshore workers, workers that were producing war materials, and so forth. So when Darcy had this success in organizing farm workers, that wasn't what the National Party and the Comintern wanted. They wanted him to focus on disrupting the potential war efforts.
And so what happened? What was Darcy's reaction? He knew that what he was doing went counter to what the National Party and the Comintern desired.
Darcy began organizing maritime workers, especially longshore workers. And he repeated what he had done with the farm workers. He found some people from the Unemployed Council, and he joined them and went to the waterfront and tried to get work as longshore workers. There was an official union, the Maritime Workers Industrial Union, communist-led, that had had a presence in San Francisco for some time, but they had been almost completely unsuccessful. Darcy's analysis was that they were much too sectarian, that you cannot organize American workers by saying, join this union and help defend the Soviet Union, which was pretty much the line taken by many of the organizers for that union. And it just wasn't successful. What Darcy did instead was to work with militants who were already on the San Francisco waterfront and make contact with the militants who were already there and work with them to form a caucus within the brand new union that was being established, the International Longshoremen's Association.
Robert Czerny joins me on Against the Grain. He is Professor Emeritus of History at San Francisco State University, and we are talking about his new book, San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 to 1958. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. Talk more about Sam Darcy's inclination to, as you write, ignore the party's revolutionary objectives in favor of immediate union objectives.
Darcy understood that if you want to organize workers, you have to talk to them about the issues that are most important to them, which is wages, hours, and working conditions, not about destroying capitalism or defending the Soviet Union. And so when Darcy sought to organize this militant group within the Longshore Union, that was always their focus. And he got some criticism for that. And when the Longshore Union went on strike at all the ports on the Pacific coast, all the way from Bellingham to San Diego, San Francisco was the center of that strike. And the San Francisco local, which was also the largest local on the West Coast, had this militant caucus within it that pushed them in directions that sometimes corresponded with the position of the Communist Party. And let me give you the first example. The Communist Party always argued against any kind of racial discrimination. But the Longshoremen's Union that had existed in San Francisco before 1919 had been for whites only. The Longshoremen's Union that existed in the 1920s, which was really more of a labor racket than a real union, had also been for whites only. But when this militant group within the Longshore Union in San Francisco began to push to end those racial discriminations, they actually found a fairly good reception from the rest of that union. And so there was actually a point before, as this union was getting organized, at which they hired a black organizer in order to try to reach out to a wide range of workers, not just white workers. So, you know, this wasn't limited to the party. It wasn't just limited to that militant caucus. They found a reception to their arguments among other leaders in that union. But they took the lead in pushing the issue.
This, of course, was the era of the New Deal. What did the Communist Party in California and nationally think of the New Deal when FDR launched it?
The National Communist Party saw the New Deal as incipient fascism. They tended to divide the world that way. You're either a fascist or not. And they especially saw things like the NRA with its blue eagle symbol as incipient fascism.
And the NRA in this case is?
The National Recovery Administration, which was a key element in the first New Deal. It was created by Roosevelt and Congress in early 1933. And the goal was to plan recovery industry by industry. And each industry was supposed to develop a code of fair competition that would include recognition of workers' unions. And so this was an effort to really expand unionization. And it helped really to bring about a major revival of unionization in 1933 and 1934. But the Communist Party found these early New Deal measures to be totally unacceptable.
And we'll talk more about FDR and the New Deal a bit later. But you brought up earlier some details about the May 1934 strike, when longshore workers up and down the West Coast went on strike under the leadership of the International Longshoremen's Association. They were joined by shipboard workers. There were pitched battles, a general strike, efforts by California's governor to protect strikebreakers, and eventually a victory for the striking workers. What role did the Communist Party play in the lead-up to that strike and the strike itself?
The longshore strike and the basic strike issues were set by district-wide ILA leaders centered really in Tacoma. And the Communist Party had nothing to do with establishing the strike issues. There was no one in the district leadership who was even close to the Communist Party. But the militant group within the San Francisco local, which included some party members and others who were close to the party but not members, fully embraced these issues and pushed very hard not to compromise them. I should also say that the leader of this militant group within the San Francisco local was Harry Bridges.
Yes, and in fact, my guest Robert Cherney has written a book about Harry Bridges. It's called Harry Bridges, Labor Radical, Labor Legend. He is Professor Emeritus. Robert Cherney is of history at San Francisco State University. We are talking about his new book, San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 to 1958. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And you write in this book about Bridges and the question of whether he was a communist, and people can read about this, but I think it's fair to sum up what your assertions in this book are on this matter by saying that he received support and advice from communists, but said he was never a member of the Communist Party. I would like to ask you about the Popular Front. So in the mid-30s, the Comintern was moving toward a Popular Front strategy. What was the Popular Front, and why did the Comintern make this change of direction?
Yeah, in the 1930s, the Comintern was really changing direction in a significant way. Under Stalin's analysis of the third period of capitalism, which was the focus of the party in the late 20s and early 30s, there was to be no cooperation with any other political organization on the grounds that socialists were undercutting the appeal of the Communist Party. Trade union leaders were undercutting the appeal of the Communist Party. During that time period, late 20s, early 30s, the party really focused a lot of its attention on those it called social fascists, which is the Socialist Party of America and AFL unions. But what was happening in other parts of the world caused the Comintern to do an about-face. What was happening in other parts of the world, in Germany specifically, where the German Communist Party had followed this approach and had really attacked the German Socialist Party, is that the Nazis came to power because the left was divided. And they began systematically eliminating what there was of the German Communist Party. This was a real wake-up call to the leaders of the Comintern that perhaps their approach had been misguided. Now, in San Francisco in 1934, Darcy had really avoided the national position on these issues, and the Communist Party in San Francisco, such as it was, fully cooperated with the AFL Longshoremen's Union and promoted the strike and did everything they could to support the strike, which meant, of course, supporting that union. And ultimately, after that strike, late in 1934, Darcy led the way to simply folding up the Communist Party Marine Workers Union and telling the members of that union to join the AFL unions and to work within those unions. This was theoretically a violation of the party's position, but it soon became the party's position. When the Communist International held one of its periodic conventions of delegates from all of the Communist parties around the world in 1935, and the new approach was announced, It's often called the Popular Front, which is not the most accurate way of describing it, but it's a way that Le Front Populaire, the French term of the People's Front, got translated into English as the Popular Front. The more appropriate term would have been the People's Front. And what the Comintern now said was, ally with everyone on the left and even include center parties, even include non-socialist parties from the center, as long as they were democratic.
What happened on the cultural front to signal this emphasis of the Communist Party in California on a broad-based popular front approach?
You see, within this, the Communist Party in California, you see the movement between late 1935, early 1936, when the party produced a brand new newspaper. They had had a newspaper called the Western Worker. It had come out several times a week. It always took the party line, of course, and a very militant paper. But they created a new newspaper. We had a new district organizer, by the way. Darcy was gone. The new district organizer was William Schneiderman, who had come out of the Communist Party in Los Angeles. And under Schneiderman's leadership, a new newspaper was created, The People's World. And it was a much more mainstream newspaper in many ways. It had a sports section. It had a children's section, it had a women's section, and almost immediately it praised Roosevelt, which was, you know, a sharp turnaround from what the party had done previously, but it was fully in keeping with the new popular front line of the Comintern.
Yeah, and that is interesting, this move by the Communist Party toward the mainstream, toward the political mainstream. How much of this was due to the fact that many Communist Party members or supporters belong to unions, and I think at this point belong to CIO unions, which the Communist Party gravitated toward at some point?
Oh, yeah, that's very much the case. The CIO came out of the 1934 AFL National Convention, when John L. Lewis, the head of the United Mine Workers, argued that the old approach of the AFL, which was to organize workers by skill, by trade, was no longer appropriate, and that what was needed was instead industry-wide organization, so that instead of dividing up the steel workers according to the most skilled and the less skilled and not even bothering with the unskilled, you have just one union for all steel workers. You have one union for all automobile workers rather than dividing up the different kinds of jobs within a factory and giving them different trade unions based on the particular skills involved. Lewis and others argued for industrial unionism, and this coincided with the perspective of the Communist Party of long standing. But the Communist Party had been very unsuccessful in carrying out its goal of creating industrial unions. In 1934, the AFL created a Committee on Industrial Organization with Lewis in charge. But not much happened. The AFL might have created the union, but they were not all that supportive. And what Lewis eventually did was to break away from the AFL and create the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and he began issuing charters. His own United Mine Workers had always been an industrial union, but he chartered the Automobile Workers Union, the Steel Workers Union, and eventually chartered the West Coast Longshore Workers as the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, as a part of the CIO. The Communist Party had organizers, effective organizers, and Lewis needed effective organizers, and he essentially cut a deal that he would stop opposing communists within the unions if they would support and work for the CIO. But of course, in some of these new unions, Communist Party members did become significant figures and even officers and even leaders at the top level.
That's the voice of Robert Czerny, C-H-E-R-N-Y, an historian, emeritus professor at San Francisco State University. His books include Viktor Arnautov and the Politics of Art, American Politics in the Gilded Age, 1868 to 1900, and Harry Bridges, Labor Radical, Labor Legend. We are talking about his new book, San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 to 1958. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Interesting how, as you write, the Communist Party's move to embrace FDR in the New Deal. By mid-1937, you write, the CPUSA was fully committed to working with New Deal Democrats. How that move increased the party's ability to influence local and state politics. Issues that the party had pressed for years became part of mainstream politics, at least for a short while. Democratic candidates for public office were willing to meet with Communist Party members to talk about how to work together and get their input on campaigns and legislation. Some very interesting history there. But I want to move to 1939. Many people will know that in August of that year, the foreign ministers of Germany and the Soviet Union, Ribbentrop and Molotov, respectively, negotiated the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact. What impact did that pact have on the party's stance toward FDR and how the party was viewed in the U.S.?
Well, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact came as a great shock to most American communists, and some of the Californian communists who left their memoirs made very clear that this was quite a shock to them, that they never expected the Soviet Union to cut a deal with Nazi Germany. But they did. It allowed Hitler to invade Poland, and at the same time, Stalin invaded Poland from the east and carved out a piece of Poland and attempted to connect it to the Soviet Union. Britain and France went to war with Germany over the attack on Poland. Hitler then turned his attention to the West and in 1940 launched a blitzkrieg that within very short order occupied a good deal of Western Europe and launched an aerial war against Great Britain. Roosevelt sided with Britain and France, so long as it was still in the war, and sought to provide aid and assistance to Britain. The Communist Party in the United States, however, interpreted the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact as an entente, an informal alliance, and they absolutely opposed any effort to assist Britain in its war against Germany. So the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and Roosevelt's support for Britain and France really ended the Popular Front, and the Communist Party nationally and in California moved back to the margins of politics. Many liberal Democrats who had worked with California communists in the 1938 election were then very hostile to the Communist Party thereafter because they felt that they'd been misled. And this extended all the way up the political ladder. President Roosevelt felt exactly the same way. He became very anti-communist as a result of the communist behavior in 1939 and 1940. And interestingly enough, the National Party and the State Party stopped issuing membership statistics in 1939. Now, I know from some of the accounts by party, local party leaders, that the party did lose members as a result of these events in 1939. They'd really gained members in the late 30s under the Popular Front. Now they lost members. And that erosion of membership continued all through 1939, 1940, and early 1941.
Robert, you also have chapters in this book, San Francisco Reds, covering the 1940s and 1950s. Give us some highlights, a couple things maybe that stand out to you about California communist activity in those decades. And as you just said, those decades begin with the communists in California moving to the margins.
Yeah, the California Party had moved to the margins as a result of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and their hostility to Roosevelt. But in 1941, Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, and instantly the Communist Party embraced Roosevelt and encouraged Roosevelt to give all possible aid to the Soviet Union to help fight off this invasion. There then developed a revival of the Popular Front, which in my book I've always referred to as the wartime Popular Front, in which once again the party embraced Democrats, embraced Roosevelt, and tried to work with all people in the center and on the left to bring unity to the war effort. In the midst of all that, however, it's clear that at least some party members continued to recognize a deep loyalty to the Soviet Union, because at least one or two party members were involved in assisting Soviet consular officials in seeking information about the atomic bomb that was being developed at UC Berkeley. That's really a sidelight. But when that became known at the end of World War II, and when a lot of other international events were coming about to really focus attention on the way that the Soviet Union had moved into Eastern Europe and set up communist regimes throughout Eastern Europe, it set off a major Red Scare, a major wave of anti-communism at the end of World War II. But interestingly enough, many of the San Francisco party leaders seem to have been especially taken by what they had been able to do in the Popular Front of the 30s and in the Popular Front during World War II. And they seem to want to continue in that vein of working with liberal Democrats in San Francisco and in California. But once again, the communist leadership in Moscow intervened and sent a clear message to the U.S. party that they were not to do anything like a Popular Front. They sent a clear message that there was a division now between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and that the U.S. party had to take a very hostile view toward Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman, and his Democratic Party. Again, this really hurt a lot of local communist members, because they'd really gotten used to working with liberal Democrats in San Francisco and in California more generally. And the party began shedding members in the late 40s and early 50s. People who just felt the party was no longer relevant. And this sense of disaffection on the part of those who had been most affected by the Popular Front coincided with major attacks on the Communist Party in the press, in Congress through the House Un-American Activities Committee, by demagogues like Joseph McCarthy, and by the Truman administration itself. So the party was under attack from the outside, but many of its members who really felt they had accomplished some important things through the Popular Front didn't like the new line that had come down to them from Moscow. And I think all of this really came together in the 1948 election, when the party was the moving force in creating an independent political organization. The Progressive Party in California was called the Independent Progressive Party, to support the presidential candidacy of Henry Wallace running against Harry Truman. And while there was certainly support for Henry Wallace within the Communist Party and more generally among liberal Democrats, he ended up doing very poorly when it became clear that so much of his campaign rested on the support from the Communist Party.
The book we've been talking about is San Francisco Reds, Communists in the Bay Area, 1919 and 1958. The author, my guest, is Robert Cherney, Professor Emeritus of History at San Francisco State University. Bob, very interesting book. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I enjoyed talking with you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.